Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Joining us today, Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Ben.
Jonathan Hasid is with us as well in Ames, where he's assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University. Jonathan, welcome to you.
Hi, Ben.
And as always, we welcome our listeners to join our politics edition of River to River, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. A little later in the program, I want to ask Jonathan and Dennis about that Trump rally in Arizona. We'll hear an excerpt from that, specifically the president addressing what he thinks is a big danger of voter fraud, voting by mail. Also, Congress's attempts at police reform. We heard that in the top of the hour news. Those primaries that took place in some states yesterday, the vote counting slowed down by our COVID pandemic. Well, let's talk about that first of all. More than 35,000 new coronavirus cases identified across the U.S., gentlemen, yesterday. This is according to the New York Times database. That is the highest single-day total since late April, the third highest total of any day of this pandemic. Now, we've been witnessing the U.S. continue to reopen its economy, also here in Iowa. But case numbers are rising in more than 20 states, mostly in the South and the West. Texas reporting more than 5,000 cases yesterday. That's its largest single-day total yet. Arizona, more than 3,600 cases, also a record for Arizona. Let's listen to testimony before Congress yesterday. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, says the country is still in the grip of the pandemic's first wave, including what he calls a disturbing surge of new cases in southern and western states.
However, in other areas of the country, we're now seeing a disturbing surge of infections that looks like it's a combination, but one of the things is an increase in community spread. And that's something that I'm really quite concerned about that. And you know that this has been something that's been in the press over the past couple of days. We were going down from 30,000 to 25 to 20, and now we sort of stayed about flat, and now we're going up. A couple of days ago, there were 30,000 new infections. That's very troublesome to me. The way you address that, and I've said this over and over again, is you have to have the manpower, the system, the testing to identify, isolate, and contact trace in an effective way so that when you see those increases, you can understand where they're coming from and you can do something about them. Right now, the next couple of weeks are going to be critical in our ability to address those surgings that we're seeing in Florida, in Texas, in Arizona, and in other states. They're not the only ones that are having a difficulty. Bottom line, Mr. Chairman, it's a mixed bag. Some good and some now we have a problem with.
Okay, Dr. Fauci, also three other leaders of the government's coronavirus response testifying yesterday. They are casting a cloud over the sunny accounts offered by President Trump. Just last week that the president claimed the virus had infected more than 2 million Americans last week and killed more than 121,000. Just last week, though, he said it would just fade away. Dennis, what do you make of this clash between science and politics, the president's politics specifically, his continued sunny assessment when we're seeing a resurgence in the number of cases in about half the U.S.?
Well, you know, there are two factors, I think. The first is quite legitimate. We're all tired of this. We're all tired of living in that house of waiting for an attack by the Night of the Living Dead creatures. You know, we're just sick and tired of all that. We want to be past it. We want to believe we can go out and spend time and socialize with other people and go out to eat. So that's a very normal kind of reaction, and being patient is really hard. The second factor, though, is certainly the president has downplayed this from the very beginning. And his approval ratings were never great anyway, but particularly on this issue, they've fallen dramatically because a majority of people in the country, by all polling, just doesn't seem to think that he's handled this well. So he wants to get past this. He wants to downplay it, get past this, and say things are improving dramatically, just we can start to get out and resume our more normal lives. And that redounds to his political benefit.
Mm-hmm. To his benefit, Jonathan, even if the science, the data, mm-hmm. continues to work against the sunny prospects, the sunny picture that he is putting out, Jonathan?
I mean, certainly he seems to think it's going to react to his political benefit. I'm less convinced that it will do so. Because, you know, again, if you look at the polling, right, as we've just heard, you know, people are quite negative on this, on how the president has handled this. And they've gotten more negative as we've moved forward. And so, you know, I think Dennis is right to point to the polling on this so that, you know, I mean, for, you know, Trump wants to wave this away and pretend that it's not a problem, but, you know, he's coming up against empirical reality that, of course, it is a problem. And I think this may partly explain why his first rally that he had in Tulsa, Oklahoma, was so poorly attended. You know, the Tulsa fire marshal saying that in an arena that could seat 19,000, he was getting about a third full, about 6,200 people. And it seems to me that it's likely that a lot of even his supporters, that is to say the people who in, you know, beat red Oklahoma are going to show up to a Trump rally, they're not buying that it's safe to do so. And so the president is in a real, you know, barrel here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about the president's rally yesterday. You mentioned the Tulsa rally on the weekend, only about a third of that arena filling there. We could talk a half an hour about the social media that perhaps went into reserving seats for people who never intended to show up. But yesterday, the president renewed his performance for a packed crowd of students, telling an Arizona audience that they were guardians in a cultural war over the heritage of the country. Images from this appearance at the Dream City Mega Church showing a large crowd tightly packed together, almost no one wearing protective masks, no temperature checks for the estimated 3,000 attendees, ignoring a new local ordinance there in Arizona requiring them to wear a mask. The president boasting about the progress administration has made in constructing the wall, venting about the removal of Confederate monuments, also about China's handling of the coronavirus outbreak. And then he spoke about one of his newer themes, voter fraud by mail. Listen to this excerpt. He predicted to this group of students at the Phoenix Mega Church that the election could be stolen in a huge fraud.
Well, where are they going? Where are these ballots going? Who's getting them? Who is not getting them? Little section that's Republican. Will they be stolen from mailboxes as they get put in by the mailman? Will they be forged? Will they be counterfeited by groups inside our nation? Will they be counterfeited maybe by the millions, by foreign powers who don't want to see Trump win because nobody has been tougher on trade or making our country great again? Nobody. No, mail-in ballots is a disaster for our country. This will be, in my opinion, the most corrupt election in the history of our country, and we cannot let this happen. They want it to happen so badly.
Okay, Jonathan Haseed, what do you believe that the president is doing here? What is his strategy there? Does he have real concerns about our election integrity?
I mean, I don't know if his concerns are real, but they're certainly not backed up by any evidence. Trump's own voter fraud commission that he started when he came into the White House at first, before it dissolved in disgrace and acrimony, found that there was no evidence of wide-scale voter fraud. You know, this was his own commission. There have been every academic study that has looked at this has found that the number of people committing voter fraud is minuscule, exceptionally tiny. The Heritage Foundation has they maintain a list of people convicted of voter fraud around the country, and there are hundreds of cases on there, but it dates back to the 1950s, during which time, of course, we've had many, many billions of ballots cast. So there's simply no evidence that ballot fraud is a widespread systemic problem. On the other hand, the president seems to think that it's politically advantageous for him to promote this idea that there is, perhaps in part because it will discredit any kind of loss, right? If the polls are accurate and the president is going to lose to Vice President Biden, this can be a way for him to challenge the results, which a lot of people are worried about. It also, of course, is a way for him to attempt to, keeping with a long partisan Republican platform of essentially voter suppression, of trying to keep voters who would not vote Republican away from the polls. This plays into that long tradition. His stated fears are not valid. There's no evidence that this can happen, and indeed it never has happened before in the United States. But perhaps it serves his partisan purposes in other ways.
Mm-hmm. Dennis Goldford, your thoughts on this point?
I pretty much agree. The president wants to fire up his base, no question about that. And he, as he did in the middle of 2016, wants to call into question, although he seems to be saying it much more directly now, that this will be a fraudulent election, unless, of course, he wins. And then, of course, everything will be on the up and up. I've said for a long time, this is extremely dangerous because elections work only when the loser agrees to lose. And for the first time in American history, at least since 1861 in Lincoln and secession, there's worry about whether, in fact, if the president were to lose, he would agree to lose. Now, we're a long way away still. There's no guarantee that the president will lose. But I think by his doing this now, he's trying both again to fire up the base and to explain why he might lose, that he didn't lose legitimately or fairly.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple minutes.
Let me just add a very brief point,
Jonathan.
That there's no evidence that voting by mail helps Democrats, right? That a few studies have been done on this seems to suggest that it helps both political parties equally. So it's strange to be attacking this.
Right, and when we're
something to use, and again, we'd note that Kayleigh McEnany has voted by mail repeatedly over the years. Mike Pence votes by mail. President Trump just voted by mail. I believe it was in the Florida primary. So again, it's a selective use of the question of mail fraud in mail-in ballots.
Right, and who knows? In just over 4 months, where we'll be with the COVID virus? We don't want to have anybody in a position of, well, should I vote and risk my life? Or should I vote by mail, which, well, it seems that our country can do that. It seems that states have demonstrated, Dennis, right, that you can vote by mail. Iowa just did.
Right. And what is it, Jonathan, is Washington or Oregon? One of them has, I think, believe strictly vote by mail, and they don't seem to have had any difficulties. But no, the president
right,
made all these various charges with no evidence at all of anything like this happening yet.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, before the break, we have just over a minute. Five states holding primaries yesterday: Kentucky, New York, North Carolina, Virginia, Mississippi. Of course, election night, different than the pandemic. Many results unknown. Dennis, let me go to you. These absentee ballots continue to arrive for days. I guess Kentucky is taking the spotlight in terms of yesterday's primaries and how well progressive Democrats are doing. In the short time we have before the break, a minute or so, tell us what your eyes are on in these primaries.
Well, for the Democrats, of course, there's always the question of whether the perfect is the enemy of the good from their perspective. And you've got this question of whether progressives want to have a challenge to more mainstream Democrats. This has occurred, I think, in New York with sitting Congressman Elliot Engel, who seems to be in big trouble and from their primary. And in Texas, McGrath she's run before. She seems has a lot of money, but has run a kind of lackluster campaign by all reports. And this particular challenger, his name escapes me at the moment, seems to have had some sort of progressive momentum.
So in Kentucky, I think you said Texas, but
I'm sorry, you're right, Kentucky. The mm-hmm. question is whether the Democrats want to, as they often do, create their own civil war in the party before the general election in November.
Okay, we'll be back after a short break with Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. When we come back, we'll talk about congressional efforts to have policing reform. That seems to be stalled. We'll get our analysts' opinions on that when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Backcountry in Des Moines, a boutique that believes, as Twain said, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. Located at 2702 Beaver Avenue, Backcountry curates clothing and gear for people who travel in mind now and in person soon.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with us, our analysts, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University, two political scientists in our stable of really excellent analysts that we have across the state in universities and colleges. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, as we move through a number of political news items. Of course, far too many items to get through in 1 hour. Let's talk about the efforts by Congress to have some sort of reform of the police. Now, we just heard in the top of the hour news that Senate Democrats have blocked a vote on Republican legislation to reform policing guidelines, calling it irrevocably flawed. Democrats move to oppose this measure has undercut the plans by the majority leader in the Senate, McConnell, to hold a procedural vote today to move on to debating that legislation. Meanwhile, the House, if you remember, days ago passed their version. The Democrat and the Republican bills dramatically different. Unlike the Democratic version, the Republican bill doesn't call for an outright ban on chokeholds or touch on the defense of this idea of qualified immunity. It would collect data on entries using no-knock warrants instead of banning them, as the Democrats would like. Let's talk about it. Explain, Jonathan, you first, what you see going on in what is, would you agree, looking like a stalemate in the Senate, in Congress, over how to address police violence and the massive outpouring of people wanting change here in police reform.
Of course, it's a stalemate. Once again, our hyper-partisan Congress and hyper-polarized society are unable to achieve things that, you know, by common consensus, most Americans seem to want. Of course, politics play into this. The Senate GOP has recognized that it is untenable for them to do nothing. The national conversation has shifted so dramatically since the George Floyd killing that even Mitch McConnell, a man who obviously doesn't like to take up Democratic legislation, has recognized that the Senate has to at least appear to be doing something, which is why this bill has come why he's proposed this bill. Of course, from the perspective of House Democrats, it doesn't go nearly far enough. And on both sides, there's clear political calculus, right? The House Democrats want to push this further and get the credit in America for pushing police reform, while the Senate Republicans, led by Mitch McConnell, want to slow this down. President Trump, of course, is running very much on a law and order campaign, and the rhetoric coming out of the White House is such that the police basically don't need to be reformed, Majority Leader McConnell is in a little bit of a tough spot, right? He's caught between the presidential rhetoric and the realities of an election year presidential race and a national groundswell of support to do something. And I don't know how this will play out. I suspect that, you know, they may be finally both sides will get together to pass something symbolic but not terribly meaningful. But the heart of the matter, in particular qualified immunity, lifting that for police officers seems to be required for House Democrats and totally unacceptable for Senate Republicans. So I don't see how we get any compromise on that.
Mm-hmm. Do you see policing reform likely, Dennis, to happen during this Congress, especially as we count down the now just over 4 months before the general election?
I think that on the part of Republicans outside of the Trump administration, there is a desire at least to pass something, as Jonathan says, of perhaps at least a symbolic aspect. But otherwise, I think that Republicans, you know, the Scott bill, Senator Scott, Tim Scott of South Carolina, that focuses on the idea of incentives. The Democrats tend to be one of approach things more in, so to speak, command and control in terms of disallowing chokeholds, things like that. I mean, the biggest federal leverage on some of these practices is of course, the control of federal money that goes into state and local police forces. You don't get the money if you don't adopt certain kinds of policies and stick to them, that sort of idea. A real distinction is this qualified immunity issue that I'm not an expert on. But, you know, when can you sue the police for going too far? Mm-hmm. And Democrats seem to want to open that up a bit more so a family or a victim can sue the police. Republicans seem to want to maintain some dimension of that qualified immunity, saying that officers cannot be sued for certain kinds of actions.
Mm-hmm. Let's jump over to some news from this past weekend. This standoff over the independence of one of the country's most important prosecutors' offices ended on Saturday. Jeffrey Berman agreed to step down. He was a U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. This is the office of the attorney general that had been investigating President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani. Berman's confirmation of his departure came after the U.S. Attorney General, A.G. Barr, told him he had been fired by Trump at Barr's request, and then that Berman's handpicked number two, Deputy Attorney Audrey Strauss, would be acting U.S. Attorney until a permanent replacement installed. So some nuance there, some details there. Dennis, cut through this. Thoughts on this episode? What is this about, and does it fit into the pattern that we've talked about before of the president?
At one level, there's a legitimate question about the extent of presidential power. This particular president argues, if you remember the statement, I have an Article 2, that means I can do anything I want. Well, that's not true constitutionally or legally, but that's the approach of this particular president. He also seems to believe that the attorney general is his new attorney general Barr seems to be his new fixer, the way that Mr. Cohen was, Michael Cohen, who got into trouble doing that privately. But the president complained. Remember, he said early on when the investigation, the Mueller investigation started, where's my Roy Cohn, you know, this attorney who would protect him from this various kinds of onslaught. So there's a real question on the part of how far the president will be allowed to go, and Republicans so far have been enablers, in asserting basically an ability to avoid and scuttle any kind of investigations into him politically, administratively, and his private affairs. So this is what's disturbing for a lot of people. Has he turned the Justice Department into a unit within the Trump organization?
Mm-hmm. Let me toss the Roger Stone affair to you, Jonathan, then, in the interest of time here. This is the federal office that led the prosecution of the president's friend, Roger Stone. This is the latest news on it. Received evidently heavy pressure from the highest levels of the Department of Justice to ease its sentencing recommendation. This from a career prosecutor, Aaron Zielinski, actually testifying to Congress today. These are according to his prepared remarks. Zielinski withdrew from the Roger Stone case in protest. He testifying today before the House of Representatives Judiciary Committee about political pressures that he said the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Columbia faced. What does this tell you, Jonathan, about the, in tandem with Dennis's comments about the current leadership of the U.S. Department of Justice?
It's quite disturbing, deeply disturbing, that the U.S. Department of Justice appears to be now the personal legal arm of the president, not of the presidency. Part of the problem here is that the Justice Department is, of course, part of the executive branch, and it has run mostly shielded from political interference by norm and tradition, not by law or constitution. And so if you have someone who is not willing to abide by these norms and traditions, like Donald Trump, and if he can find an enabler like Bill Barr, then the two of them can run roughshod over centuries of tradition that dictate that the president shouldn't be the highest levels of the Justice Department shouldn't be personally involved in directing investigations that may affect them personally. I mean, it's really quite disturbing. It's part of a trend, that we saw with Michael Flynn, which is now before the courts. That we saw with, I mean, even just the attempted firing and then ultimate resignation, as you mentioned, of Prosecutor Berman over the weekend. These all paint a picture that, unfortunately, Attorney General Barr and the top echelons of the Justice Department seem to think that their job is some sort of conciliary figure rather than Attorney General to the United States. It's a problem.
Mm-hmm. In the final 10 minutes of our program, let's move over to more to the Democratic side and talk about the 2020 election. Another poll, and we've seen these over the last couple of weeks. Joe Biden, in this new New York Times Siena College poll of the general election, has a 14-point lead over President Trump. Biden leads by wide margins among younger, non-white voters, running virtually even among voters over the age of 45 and white voters, interesting groups to pay attention to because they are groups that Hillary Clinton lost in 2016. Dennis, I don't know if you had a good look at this poll today, but other recent polls by other organizations have found on average that Biden is leading by on average 10 points. What do you see in these latest poll numbers?
I see weakness for the president. I mean, there's no question about that. There is weakness, which is one of the reasons why he's doing some of the wild kinds of charges he's making at his rallies. And, of course, he loves the rallies just for the gratification of having adoring fans cheer for him. But, I keep cautioning. We're still over 4 months away from the election, so I don't think that the Biden folks should be measuring the drapes in the White House yet, by any means. Certainly the Clinton people saw that 4 years ago. But the president is showing weakness among older voters and among white voters generally. He won those handily last time around. So the fact that he wanted even more than the normal number of debates showed that his folks feel that he's behind, because, you know, if you're ahead, you want to limit the number of debates so as not to give your challenger any more airtime and FaceTime and legitimate his campaign. Mm-hmm. So the president, I think, is worried about losing this. And the most important thing for this president is always to be a winner, never to be a loser. So he's at the moment, I think, running scared.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, on this program not too long ago, during the Democratic primary, a lot of consternation among Democrats. We discussed that Biden was not the candidate who could unite the party when we had the big face-off between the progressives and the candidates and the more moderate candidates. Do we have the answer to that when we see this latest poll a 14-point lead in the poll?
I do, yeah. Biden has clearly emerged as a candidate that most of the party can unite behind. Now, there are going to be obviously some hardcore, for instance, Bernie Sanders supporters who are not likely to get behind him, even though Bernie himself has endorsed Biden. What's key for Biden is a couple of things. First is that, you know, he's seen as a moderate, right? He's not seen as a scary bomb thrower like an Elizabeth Warren or a Bernie Sanders would be. And so that helps bring the more moderate wing of the party certainly aligned behind him. But also for the more radical or the more left end of the party, for most of them, the key fact is that Biden isn't Trump, right? If you look at solidity of numbers, a lot of Donald Trump supporters are really passionate supporters, and a lot of Biden supporters are sort of softer supporters. And if you ask people why they're voting, the Trump supporters will tend to say that they're voting because they support Donald Trump. The Biden supporters tend to say that they're voting to oppose Donald Trump. And so if Biden can just ensure that this is an election, a referendum on Trump and not about Biden, then he's sitting relatively pretty, as the polls would indicate. I mean, to echo what Dennis said, of course, we're 4.5 months out. Lots of things can happen. But The president's poll numbers have been quite stable, the most stable we've ever seen for an incumbent in his first term. And so it seems unlikely to me that, barring some kind of extraordinary event in a year full of extraordinary events, it seems likely to me that the race is mostly baked in and it's a referendum on the president.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday evening. Oh, yeah, Dennis, go ahead.
I was just going to say, remember 4 years ago that both Clinton and Trump were underwater in terms of approval. More people disapproved than approved. Mm-hmm. But the people who were undecided and disapproved of both went strongly for Trump. So Trump, again, wants to tear down Biden as much as possible. He wants to avoid making this a referendum on him. He wants to say, Biden is so awful, you got to take me as the lesser evil.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Joe Biden's vice presidential nominee choice. A lot of speculation over many weeks. I think in August we are to, at least the campaign says it will announce this choice. Dennis, to you first, what are your thoughts on potential nominee picks and how the news events of recent weeks have perhaps shaped what Biden already says will be a woman as his choice?
Well, of course, he's made the case that he will pick a woman as a vice presidential running mate. I just want to quickly reaffirm my quadrennial claim that the vice presidency is more of a media story than an immediate story of a tremendous impact on a campaign. But that being said, this certainly drove Amy Klobuchar out. She probably knew she wasn't going to get the nomination anyway. She had problems with African Americans, particularly in her prosecutorial days, and this she gracefully bowed out before she had a chance of being rejected. So this may well, in fact, increase the possibility of Mr. Biden selecting an African American woman to be his running mate. But for right now, there's a lot of speculation, and I wouldn't want to be the person talked about a lot right now, because it's going to be another 6 weeks before he actually makes the decision, or at least announces it.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, let me put you in as an advisor to the Biden campaign. What factors would you be telling others in that campaign to be weighing most heavily?
A lot of it, of course, is, I mean, as Dennis said, the vice presidential choice is sort of a marginal, it has a marginal effect on political campaigns. It doesn't seem to matter a huge amount. And so that being the case, I would advise Biden to go relatively bold. You know, the downside here is relatively limited, and the upside means that he could potentially, by picking, say, a woman of color, that he could align himself with this groundswell of social movements and the protests that we're seeing around the country. It also, the front runner seems to be, at least by the betting markets, the predicting markets, the front runner is Kamala Harris, who's handily up in ahead. She has, obviously, she's a woman of color, and so she has that advantage. I think she would be a less good choice because of her own prosecutorial background. So she was as a very tough prosecutor, and perhaps this isn't the moment for that. The fact that she's from California isn't going to help, Biden very much. I mean, California is a lock anyway. So if I were an advisor to the Biden campaign, I would tell them to sort of look elsewhere. But, you know, of course, who knows? I guess we'll all find out.
Right. After a few more weeks of speculation, let's talk about Iowa. I was looking at the Des Moines Register earlier today, and I think the headline said something about Battleground Iowa, Dennis. I don't know if you've seen that in the Des Moines Register, talking about how now polls months ago, Iowa was not thought to be a battleground, thought to be leaning or safe Republican for this upcoming general election. Now the president not looking as good in poll numbers. Also, the Senate race between Senator Joni Ernst and the Democratic nominee Teresa Greenfield, interesting as well.
Right. The Trump campaign won Iowa 4 years ago by about 9 percentage points. We have to remember we have a Republican governor who won narrowly but still somewhat comfortably 2 years ago. We have a Republican House and a Republican Senate. So people sometimes ask, is Iowa purple any longer, or is it more of a red tint, a Republican tint? The fact that the president seems to be in, at least he's not desperately in trouble in Iowa, but Iowa all of a sudden looks like not necessarily a sure bet. That indicates his broader national issue. And then you twin this with the Ernst Greenfield campaign. The Trump people certainly don't want increased turnout in that Senate race to sink Biden if there's increased turnout for Teresa Greenfield. But, you know, where, and you may have the same thing over in Iowa City, but certainly here in the central Iowa media market, we've been inundated with ads for and against both Greenfield and Ernst already. There's supposedly about $46 million booked already in TV ads by outside groups, not to mention the campaigns themselves, for that race. So we're going to be wallowing in this until November election day.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, we have just under 2 minutes. Give us a quick update on this story, because I know you have expertise on Asia and China. The U.S. designating four more Chinese news organizations as foreign missions brings to 9 the total number of Chinese state news organizations the U.S. State Department has designated with that label. In a minute, what is this about? Help us understand this before we say goodbye.
It's part of the, you know, new strategic rivalry between China and the United States. It's part of the way that Donald Trump can push China on the trade deal and push China to act more responsibly in world affairs. As an aside, let me say that these new media organizations that have been designated are, in fact, Chinese state media. They have been for decades. They just haven't been designated as such to avoid a tit-for-tat, where China then designates things like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal as state media in the United States, which of course they're not, but that won't stop the Chinese. And so administrations have held off of this for political reasons, but legally, unquestionably, these are in fact Chinese state media. But the last time this happened, China expelled a number of American journalists, particularly from the Wall Street Journal. I'm actually friends with one of the journalists who was expelled. And this was the first time that American journalists had been expelled since the 1970s. And so this is, unfortunately, the media is becoming yet another victim in the push-pull and the back-and-forth strategic rivalry between Beijing and Washington.
Okay, we'll have to end it there. Jonathan Hasid, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Dennis Goldford, Professor of Political Science at Drake University. Jonathan and Dennis, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ben.
Tomorrow on the program, we'll listen back to a conversation especially relevant for our times now. Iowa-based author and historian Jeff Biggers talks about his book in a conversation from 2017 titled Resistance, Reclaiming an American Tradition. A look at the fact that Americans were organizing and mobilizing acts of resistance dating way back to the founding of our nation. That's tomorrow on the program. River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us, and please help pitch in with our pledge drive here, our very shortened but important pledge drive on Iowa Public Radio.